If I may, brethren.
G'day, mates.
A little language I picked up out in Australia. My wife and I were very blessed to be able to go down there for the feast this year. Let me tell you a little bit about the story, because it is quite miraculous in one sense. Eric Morris, under the direction of Mr. Gross here, conducted a survey of the folks down in Australia. How many of them would be interested in having a CGI service begun or a feast site? And the response was very good. And I don't know, but I have heard that I called you for some other completely different reading or meaning or purpose, and you were talking about it at that moment. And Mr. Gross says, well, Mr. Chapman, would you like to go down to Australia? This was in August, to find out what the real interest is in Church of God and getting things going again down there. And I said, absolutely, I would love to go down. And so my wife and I traveled to Australia for approximately 2 weeks, and we spoke, first of all, in Sydney, then down to Melbourne, and up to Brisbane, and we met with a total of 66 people, which is a pretty good turnout on very short notice. And among many brethren of the church who have pretty much gone independent. Now, it wasn't true of everybody, because we found out quite a few of those folks had never heard about the International or the Independent Church of God, I guess it was, and they said, no, we want our own feast site. We want to be a part of the Church of God International. We want to do a work. And so we met with very favorable response. I had asked people to fill out a card. They would like to be on our mail list again, and if they would like to have their own Feast of Tabernacles. And they had responded very favorably. I think we had confirmations for it's either 12 or 15. I don't remember which ones it was, not including my wife and me, of course. And so what are we going to do? We have approximately 4 weeks before the feast. And for those of you who've been festival coordinators, Mr. Lauren Chamberlain here knows all about that at King's Beach, it's not exactly what you call a snap job. It's something that does require a little effort to prepare the Feast of Tabernacles, if it be even for a few people. One thing I know about myself, and I think my wife will agree, and many that know me, I am a man of action. I don't like to procrastinate, put things off. And I said, well, let's have a feast. And therefore, we proceeded very quickly, in orderly fashion, to sign up a feast site, make arrangements for flowers and all the things that need to be done, appointed a festival coordinator, Mr. Dusan Zubovic, who did a wonderful job of getting everything organized, and trying to advertise it as soon as possible. And with Mr. Eric Morris's help, we sent a letter out very quickly to all the mailing lists down there, tell them that we're having a Feast of Tabernacles in Albury, Australia. And as it turns out, 16 people showed up, were registered, and it's probably the smallest feast site in the world, but a lot of the biggest hearts that I've ever met in the world as well. We had a wonderful time. We did everything together. Went on outings together. We ate together. It was one of those old-fashioned feasts where everybody was together, one big happy family. And I spoke four times, and then we had two sermon tapes from Mr. Armstrong and one sermon tape from Mr. Gross, and we did not have services on Friday because that was the one day we could not rent the hall. It had already been previously booked solid in this place. Instead, we had a Bible study that Friday night in one of the members' rented homes. And everybody was there, all gathered around the living room and discussing the Bible and enjoying, I hope enjoying, I think they did, a prophecy Bible study. Everybody loves prophecy Bible studies, you know that, don't you? Sure you do. And it was like this the whole feast. Weather-wise, incredible. Perfect. We were coming out of spring, going into late spring down in Australia. And so the weather was getting a little bit nicer every day, but we had rain one time at night. So the weather was clear, bright, sunny, gorgeous, like it's been right here in Texas the last couple of days. A little brisk at night, a little cool, but boy, I'm telling you, people really were thrilled with the prospects of, once again, trying to reach out to 18 million Australians, which you might think, well, that's very, very small. You're right. In a country almost as large as the United States, if not at least the size of continental U.S., you have only 18 million people. We've got more people than that living in the city of Los Angeles. And those folks live in, about 90% of them, in six major cities in Australia. They are not scattered around that country. They're clustered primarily on the East Coast. And so it is possible when you speak to the cultural center of Australia, Melbourne, and then the industrial center of the city, Sydney, and then in the Bible Belt, as we call it up in Sydney, I'm sorry, in Brisbane, you are basically going to reach a great number of people. And if you had television outlets in those three cities, and the other ones are Perth on the west coast, and Canberra, the capital, and then one other up north, you basically are covering a majority of the people. The other folks are scattered. I mean, a typical sheep ranch or farm or whatever you want to call it out there is thousands of acres, because it's not really that fertile of a... It's a nice fertile land, but they don't have the water. I tell people, you know, if they just had one set of Rocky Mountains right in the middle of that country, you'd have a completely different climate, and you would have thousands and thousands of more arable land, but they just don't have that. It's very dry in the interior. Rain falls along the east coast and keeps that nice and plush. And my wife and I had a chance to see a lot of the country when we were down there. And we spent one night with Doosan in his home, living. He lives out in a little town called Eskdale. And I mean, it's a little one. You don't want to blink your eyes too long or you'll be right through it. And he lives in what they call the Mitta Valley. And all I can say about that valley, as you drive through the little lanes and down the little roads and you see all these cows, they are so contented and so fat and so plump. It reminds you of the 7 good years of Joseph. That's what you see. You see this wonderful land, grass that's 6, 8, 10 inches tall, thick, lush. And that little valley there produces all of the milk for that whole region around the major cities of Albury, Wodonga, and even milk down to Melbourne, which is only about 3 or 4 hours drive away. It's a very prosperous land. You're really surprised at how much wealth they have in Australia. It's under their feet by the millions and billions of dollars, untapped. Because they have a philosophy, why should we dig out our own minerals and resources when we can buy them less expensively from Indonesia and Malaysia and places slightly north of them? And so they're preserving their huge coal reserves. And they are not really developing their land primarily because of the greenies. Now, what's a greenie? He's a tree hugger. And I don't mean hug the trunk of the tree of the doctrines of the Church of God International. I mean, don't let anything happen to the ecology. Don't build dams. No open pit mines. Oh, brother, that's an anathema to have anything like that. And so let's just preserve what we got and let's enjoy the good life. And believe it or not, that's about all the Australians do. They are very much concerned about creature comforts. They're very much concerned about a good life. They love their pokies, poker machines. They are big on gambling. And essentially, they love the good life. And 11% officially are unemployed. In actuality, it's probably closer to 20%. That's what everybody tells me. So 4 people are working to support a very large socialistic government that takes care of you, as many, many of the government services are being turned over to the private sector, those people are being put on the dole. And their dole is a generous dole. And my wife and I said, you know, living out here in this Mitta Valley and enjoying all this peaceful land, and it's very tempting. Instead of going back to the busy old United States, to stay there in that beautiful land and that beautiful country, we visited a nearby area that produces probably the world's finest fortified wines. Wonderful countryside. Friendly people. But they're not going to escape the troubles that are coming any more than anywhere else in the world. And I think they understand that they won't. But nonetheless, it was quite an eye-opener to realize we have a work going again down in Australia. Right this moment, as I speak, which is probably Sunday afternoon down there in the land down under. They're doing nothing, of course, except enjoying the good life, football matches and that type of thing. But Monday morning again, our law firm that we have selected down in Australia will be busy registering the Church of God International down there. We're not going to go in there as a... what was it called? A private trusteeship. And that's what owned all of the assets of all the things we had done in Australia until this trouble came along, and we have to start all over from scratch, basically. But we're going to be a registered church, we'll open a bank account, and we'll start to begin to receive offerings. The feast was paid for completely by the people's offerings. Not one. We had actually several $100 left over to start a little bank account with. Now, that, of course, does include my wife's and my travel down there, because that's just something that I could not afford without good help from home office here. And we only have 16 people, which you might think is very, very small. And you're right, it is. But they're really a dedicated bunch of people. And they want to get that warning message out to those 18 million people, because up there in Indonesia and Malaysia and just a little bit further north is China with its billion plus people. They look down there at that fat land of Australia and all its mineral resources and all the land and all the irrigation they could have, and how many people could they feed? I can't imagine. But they look down at that land and say, boy, would I like to have that. Well, I like to be down there. And there are many Asians moving into Australia now to cash in on the prosperity of that country. Even though they're very socialized, they still have an awful lot going for them. But they don't have the truth. They don't have that gospel being preached on radio and television. And quite often, particularly I remember one gentleman I baptized down there, remarked that he had come in and out of the church, never a baptized member, but interested always, and that he would drift back in the world, and he would have this trauma or that problem, and then he'd come back and get excited about things. And finally, he heard the newscasters talking about the United States of Europe and the troubles that were coming, and all of a sudden a bell rang in his mind. A bell that had been put there, thoughts had been put there years and years before by Mr. Armstrong, who had talked about that a long time ago, and all of a sudden he sat up and said, I've got to do something about this truth. I know that's going to happen. I was told that 20 years ago. And so he began he attended the lectures that I had down there, and then he talked to me about baptism. He said, I got to get baptized. And as far as I could tell, this gentleman was ready. He was baptized. And there is a little cadre of people down there in Sydney that are going to begin a host group. Now, all our folks didn't come because many of them had followed this independent Church of God and had gone to our previous feast site in Kiama. And we had encouraged those people to make a stand and decide what's right, what should they do, and they were already very much disillusioned. And they told me that they were going to resign this other organization and begin a host group in the Brisbane area after the feast. And it's somewhere between 16 and 18. So we potentially have a good possibility that we can double our attendance next year at the Feast of Tabernacles. And I'm hoping we'll get all those people back. They told me, really, we never quit the Church of God International. They became what we called, affectionately down there, the closet CGI people, who had not come out publicly and said they were CGI, but their hearts were in it. Their spirits were in it. They wanted to do a work. They wanted to do something to help our 18 million other Australians know what's going to happen to them. And don't be surprised that Australia falls into deeper problems before the United States or Great Britain does. There are just too many billions of people down there that are looking very covetously at their land. And so they may have some real troubles early on in the game. It's going to be a really tragic time for those people if they're not told what's going to happen. I could quote to you Ezekiel 33, the responsibility of the watchman. And I think that those people want to do that job. They're not satisfied with playing the pokies, going down to Melbourne and visiting the largest casino in the world. My wife and I walked through it from one end to the other. It's a big one. And it goes downstairs in what they call the Las Vegas section. So I know I've been in Las Vegas many times, as my wife and I live in Provo, and that's only about a 6 or 7 hour drive. Many times we've gone through that town. We used to have a little host group down there. And I admit, Las Vegas has got a lot of gambling casinos. But this one was really big. And who was in it? A lot of Asians bringing their monies down there, try to hit it big in the pokies or all of the various kinds of gambling functions they have down there. And there's a name they have for their lotto or their lottery. But they spend money all the time in the hopes of hitting it big. Kind of like we do here in this country, a lot of people. They hope they can strike a bridge on a $2 bet. In their case, the dollar in Australia is worth about 75 cents U.S. So it's a good exchange for us right now. Of course, things are a little more expensive. at least in terms of Australian dollars. Well, we went ahead and we got that feast site going and we really enjoyed it. And Mr. Zubovic and his son, 16 years old, and his son's best friend set up and operated all the video equipment, all the audio equipment. Everything went without a hitch. We just had a wonderful time. We're sorry we had to leave, but you know, we needed to get home and find out what's happening back here in the States. And because there was a 16 hours difference, now what are we now? We're about 11 o'clock, 11:30. So it's 17 hours from here? 17 hours from here. So it's tomorrow afternoon over there. 17 hours, 5 plus 12, it's about 6 o'clock in the morning, I guess. It was very difficult for me to get in touch with anybody over here, and they all thought the same thing. We just weren't able to communicate to find out how things were going in the rest of the feast site. I found out as soon as I got back that everybody had a wonderful feast. So I don't know how you compute 0 to 16. What kind of a percent increase is that? I know you had about 12 or 14% increase in your feast attendance, which is really terrific. I haven't figured out how to compute 0 to 16 yet. Does anybody figure that one out? You know what it is mathematically? Infinite increase. Well, I'll be very happy with a 50% increase next year. And if we get our bank account and if we get our mailing address, then we can begin to process more and more mail as people send in support for this work. They want to do a work. Now, being a man of action, and I want results now, I found a long time ago, and I have enough loved ones who like to keep me acquainted with that fact, is I also lack patience. Patience with other people, especially, because I expect things to get done very quickly. I expect people to act. I mean, I've been in a position of management for such a long time that, you know, when you say, hey, I need to have this done, and somebody's going to do it for you. And I try very hard to learn a valuable lesson. What it says in Galatians 5, chapter 22, the fruit of the Spirit is love and joy, peace, patience. That means long suffering. And when you get a little bit older, as I have been here getting older every day, you realize that you're very thankful that God has a great deal of patience. Because you know you make a lot of mistakes. You know you need God's patience in your heart, in your mind, and you have to learn to be as patient towards others as God has been towards you. And I realize I've certainly got a long way to go to build that kind of patience. And it also explains to me a very important principle, and I know you're familiar with it, you've heard it before. Why does God not punish swiftly? Why is God doesn't act on the terrible sins and crimes and corruption in this world? People murdering their fellow man. Why doesn't he act and just stamp that out? Well, first of all, it's not the millennium. He will in the millennium. And the reason is because he has infinite patience. And he gives people time to repent. He gives us more time to straighten out our lives than you can imagine. And I don't think that God, for one second, is pushed to the edge as he and Christ discuss a particular individual, maybe you, maybe me, I'm not sure, and says, well, that's it, man, I'm not going to give him another moment. I'm going to kill him on the spot, or I'm going to punish him right now. He's just not like that. In fact, the reason why he's not like that is very simple. Time doesn't mean anything to God. Now, let me explain what I mean. When God created this universe, its vastness, its billions of planets, all the things we see around us, galaxies that you can't imagine, size and scope, he also created time. Time was not in existence before this universe. And we measure time by how the Earth rotates. Right? Some of us have been blessed to use the 24 hours of day profitably. Others have said, I'll just rather vegetate at the television set and waste time. But we have a finite amount of it. But God doesn't. I know it's hard to understand. God has infinite time. And so when he says he's going to bring a trial or a test upon a person, and he starts that trial or test coming along, it's hard on us. It's difficult on us. Nobody likes to go through a great illness. Nobody likes to go through a great trial for a long period of time. But you come to understand when God says a day is as 1,000 years to him, that time doesn't mean the same thing to him.
And it's not that he's callous towards our suffering or our discomfort. Time means something different to God. And what that means to God is this. I am interested in the final product, and I don't care how much time it takes. I want those people to be ready for the kingdom of God. I want them to qualify. I want them to overcome. And if it takes 100 years, your whole lifetime, and then some more, he says, okay. Because he's interested in the final product. Are you qualified? And so when we sometimes have trials that last a whole month, we think, oh, Word, please, God, deliver from me. Summer goes by. Oh, God, how much longer? A year goes by. It's not that God is unaware of all that. Jesus Christ lived a human life, so he knows what it's like to suffer. But God says, no, it's just not the time yet. I'm not too worried about it. I've often thought how God would react to the time of the end. I can picture God sitting there at his throne and Jesus at his right hand, and they're talking. You know, is this the time? Shall I go? Shall I return to the earth? And I sometimes wonder how God will react. He's analyzed everything, and he says they're just about ready to destroy themselves from the face of the earth. We've got to act. Now, what do you think God will do? Think about it in the context that time doesn't mean the same thing to him as it does to us. A lot of people will say, yeah, it's time, praise God, let's do it. And be all enthusiastic and just filled with energy and power and shouting for joy. And all the angels jump up and down for joy. Jesus said, this is it. At last, after all this time, which doesn't mean anything to them, you know what God's going to say? It's time. In a very calm, collected voice. And Jesus say, yes, sir. And he'll do it. And of course, we know what's going to happen then because everything in this world is going to come apart. But you learn a valuable lesson about patience because God is so patient with us as he has been with all his patriarchs and all the people in the Bible because he's interested in the final end product. And to him, whether you suffer a day, a month, or a year is not as important as what do you do with the time you've been given? How do you use that time? How do you take those 24 hours, not only use the time profitably, but use that time in the right priority? And he wants to see in you this character that's going to qualify you to be a part of his family. Now, there's a lot of encouragement in the Bible about time and how you use your time. I want you to read with me Matthew chapter 24 and verse 3. And you all know the Olivet prophecy of chapter 24. I want to read just a few verses in here to show you what I mean about the end product. And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives in verse 3 of Matthew 24, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Why is it we as humans are so interested in time? Simple. We haven't got very much of it. And the older you get, you have a whole lot less. And the disciples were no different from us. They wanted to know the times. How much more time? Even the Apostle Paul thought that he was living in the end times. We think today we're living in the end times. I feel like we are. You've traveled around the world a little bit, you can see the conditions of this world and ask yourself, boy, how much more time is there anyhow? And so the disciples ask him, what is the time all about? Jesus has been said unto them, see to it that no man misleads you. Many will come in my name, saying that I am Christ, and will mislead many. It's always interesting how Jesus says the very first thing when these discussions come up, watch out for those false prophets. You will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. Don't be frightened, for these things must take place, but that is not yet the end. Oh yeah, we always want the end to be here tomorrow. It's not going to be that way. You're going to have a few more years of suffering. And then you're going to have really tough suffering. And then you're going to have tribulation. And then you're going to have martyrdom, perhaps. That's not a very pleasant future to look forward to, is it? Think of it in terms of God. He's interested in the finished, final product. He doesn't want to see you just squeak by in qualification. He wants you to be a champion, a giant in the kingdom of God. He's reserving for a lot of you very important positions in His family because you are doing the work of God. He wants to see you qualify for the very best. Why else did He say, have 100-fold? Double your talents. It wasn't always, well, be satisfied with a little bit of 5% gain. Well, you can get that at the banks, He told His disciples. No, He wants you to double your talents, 100-fold in your fruits. He wants to give you the time to do it. So you may have a few more trials, but that's all right. Nation will rise against nation, verse 7. Kingdom against kingdom. In various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. We had an aunt that we met quite some time ago at one of my wife's reunions back there near Omaha. It may have been in Omaha. I'm not sure it was in Omaha. Yes, it was. And she said to my wife an expression that I'll never forget, nor will she, you know, old age is not for sissies. Because the older you get, the more ills and the problems you have and the more frustrations there are. By the way, what is frustration? It's thwarted self-will. It means you don't get what you want now. And therefore, you get frustrated. That's not the way we should be. That's one of the lessons God's trying to teach us. It's the fruit of the Holy Spirit, patience. They will deliver you up to tribulation, will kill you, and will be hated by all nations on account of my name's sake. When you read these verses, do you know that they really apply to us? Or are you still of the old school of the things we're just going to be wafted off to some place of safety? It's not going to happen. As I've said so many times, it doesn't make any sense to me that God had put 40 man years into developing me, or more, 50, 60 years, and I'm not that old yet. And then just yank me out, put me in a cave, when the time I need to be here to help the people, my neighbors, all of whom are Mormons, nice people, totally deceived, to be able to tell them what's happening and what they needed to do. Go see their fellow Mormon. You know what their fellow Mormon would tell them? I have no idea. I know that they're very much set on their food stores and protecting those food stores, and they're putting their trust in materialism. And then the things that go along with protecting themselves. Do I have to spell it out any clearer than that without saying it? Do you know what I'm talking about? I hope you do. At that time, many of you will fall away and will betray one another and hate one another, and many false prophets will arise, will mislead many. And because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end... Now, that implies no matter how much time there is that God has allotted us, no matter what circumstances befall us, He says you got to hang in there till the end. Because it says, the one who endures to the end, it is he who shall be saved. See, in God's plan, there's no easy out. Unless He takes your life supernaturally, as He's done a couple of times in life. I'd rather meet Christ in the air, frankly, than have to rise from my grave. Although I have no idea what's going to happen in the future. But I know that we have to endure to the end. Because God is interested in the end product. If He brings an extra trial upon you, be thankful. He's really interested in you. In fact, He never brings any trials at all on you. I don't know whether He loves you or not. Because He brings trials on those that He loves. The same way you rear your children. They have to be punished now and then, spanked, corrected. And He certainly believes in that philosophy for us as well. Well, you go back in the book of Hebrews in chapter 11, you know what that chapter is all about. It's about all the people that endured all these trials for all these years. You probably wonder, how in the world did they make it? How in the world did they live through the kinds of troubles they lived through? All those years. I want to give you a couple of examples in just a second. Emphasize this point, but he says in chapter 11, verse 13 this, all these died in faith, No matter what the trial was, and some of them met some pretty ugly ends or deaths. All these died in faith without receiving the promises. But having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. So maybe some of us more often should say, bring on the trials, God. Help me endure. Help me really have the strength to face the little trials today so I can face the big ones tomorrow. Because it's going to be a very ugly world and not much time. I know trials and tests might seem like a lifetime to us. I commiserate with Mary Lou right now because she has had a trial of faith for a long time. Do you think God's not interested in her? Or is he more interested in the end product and the faith that that woman is building through this great trial? The faith of endurance, faith of patience. Those are the kind of people that I want to see in God's kingdom. People that can understand this world and deal with the people of this world and the way they've been brought up and the way they've lived. The troubles they've had. I want people who have experienced things to be my judge. And of course, Jesus Christ is my judge, and he's experienced anything and everything a human being should ever have to experience. But they all died without receiving the reward. Are we any better? Are we going to die receiving the reward without going through the trials and tests? Read Hebrews 11. Compare yourself to some of those folks. Of whom the world was not even worthy, it says. There are a few people in the Bible that never learned any lessons, no matter how much time they were given. You would think if an individual were given 930 years, well, that ought to be enough to really teach him a few things. And maybe after 930 years, and looking around and seeing what his progeny had done to the world, you would think that Adam would have had a little bit of understanding in his heart. Maybe a little bit of forgiveness. Maybe a little bit of repentance. But you know, there's nothing in the Bible about Adam ever repenting. Maybe he had a worldly sorrow. You would too if you saw millions of your children about killing each other, living like wild animals, taking of whatever they wanted, rape and pillage. Look at that line of Cain alone and all the things that are said about it. Wouldn't you as a parent? Sure you would as a parent, because you have God's Spirit. You'd look down and see what your children are doing and you'd be very heartsick. But there's no indication that Adam ever was. And Jewish tradition says that she had, I think it's 35 children. She was very healthy, all right. And they saw those children with their hundreds of grandchildren, and there are thousands of grandchildren, just bickering and fighting and arguing. I mean, it was very disheartening to Adam and Eve to see what was happening to them. You would think under those circumstances he would have been a little bit sorrowful for it. Maybe once in his life say, God, please forgive me for what I've done. No, I think he may have died cursing God. Not in the sense of committing an unpardonable sin, but I mean never really saying, boy, it's my fault. I blew it. And God, you gave me 930 years. I still didn't get the point. Genesis chapter 6. Here's a man that we all know about. He was 480 years old. Now, that is a lot of experience under your belt before you even do anything for God. 480 years old. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 11. Now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. Here was a world that had gone crazy. Here was a world where it was really dog-eat-dog. It was violence to defend yourself. It says all the thoughts of their heart was evil continually. This was a very, very wicked world. God looked at the earth in verse 12, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. There wasn't a righteous man around except God saw one. Not his wife, not his three sons, not his three daughters-in-law. One, Noah. A preacher of righteousness, says the scripture. God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, For the earth is filled with violence because of them. Behold, I am about to destroy the earth. What kind of patience does God have? He was filled with anger against all the things that people were doing to themselves and the troubles they were getting into. The unhappiness they were expressing. He can see the people dying in agony. Now I'll give you another 120 years. That's a pretty generous God. I'll give you another 120 years. I'll let Noah preach to you for 120 years times 52 Sabbaths plus the holy days if he kept those and understood them. Maybe one or two of you might wake up and listen and hear that word. God said to Noah, verse 13, the end of all flesh has come upon the earth, fill the earth with violence. Behold, I'm about to destroy the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. You shall make the ark with rooms and shall cover it with inside and out with pitch. This is how you shall make it. And he gave him this description of how to build this boat, which was the size of a large football field, more like a soccer field. Huge. And you got 120 years to do it. Now, there's a pretty big task to give a man who's already 480 years old. How would you like to have a job when you're, say, 65? I tried to think to myself, how could I picture building an ark? Because you read about it, you wonder about it, you think, how did he do it? He had three sons, three daughters-in-law, and a wife, and he has to build an ark the size of a large soccer field. So I said, what can I compare to that? All right, how would you like to be given the job at age 65? Of cutting all the stones out of the mountains of Vermont and hauling them down by vehicle or whatever, a cart, and build by hand the Washington Monument by yourself and your three sons. Cutting out every stone, shaping it, bringing it down there in the cart, putting it in place, fitting it just right, and building this tower up, Washington Monument. And I don't even know if that's even comparable. But to give you an idea, how would you like to have that job? God says, well, I want you to start it now, and I'll let your life extend till you finish it, but it's only going to be 120 years. You're already 65. And not only that, Noah, I want you to preach the gospel every Sabbath. And as those crowds came around and they saw this keel being laid in the middle of this, I don't know what it was, and certainly wasn't right in the middle of a bank right by a nice big river. It was right out in the middle of the wilderness. They saw this keel being laid, and you know what that was called by all the inhabitants of the earth, as I jokingly say? That was the Disney World of the pre-Noahian world. Everybody took their kids up there and had a party and just laughed and cheered and thought this is the craziest thing that any individual ever thought of doing, to build a boat that big out here in the middle of the desert. And we're having all this wonderful climate. We have all this food. And every Sabbath he'd put down his tools and have a nice rest. And then he'd preach services the next day and tell everybody they got to repent because the world's going to be flooded. Oh, Noah, you have really gone off the deep end. Well, he was about to go off the deep end in his ark. They didn't realize that yet. So he preached to them every Sabbath. How many converts did Noah have?
None.
None. 120 years of preaching the truth. A major attraction in the world. Nobody was ever converted. I guess that would be very discouraging to a minister, wouldn't it? Preach that long and never get a convert. Way year in and year out, and as that boat began to rise in planes, got a little higher, the crowds got a little bit bigger. And they laughed a lot more. Of course, when it started to rain, there was a little bit of concern there. But it was just a little rain squall to begin with. And it was way off over there in the distance. And the clouds got a little blacker and the rain got a little heavier. And besides that, where's Noah? Well, he went into the ark and it's been sealed up. Whew! People were frightened then. You see, regardless of the size of the task that God gives us, we got to do it. If you've got some problems or some faults in your life, you've got some weaknesses, you've got some shortcomings, you've got to overcome them. Because you don't know how much more time God's going to give you. You know this fact, He is interested in the end product. And He's going to work out the circumstances to help you come to realize you've got to go to work. You've got to overcome that problem. Well, 600 years of age, that flood came, wiped out all the earth except Noah, his wife, and his three sons and three daughters-in-law. And to start all over again. It was a beautiful world. But by that time, of course, it had been filled with all kinds of thorns and thistles. And it was a very miserable world because everybody was so crazy, insane in their lusts and their violence. Abraham, Genesis chapter 12. We know about Abraham. Do we know how much time God gave Abraham? Do you know what he was asked to do? Do you realize the extent of his trial? A trial that none of us has ever experienced, that I'm aware of at least. Here's old Abraham. He's living very comfortably. He's got his family around him. He's got his inheritance coming. Maybe he's living in a nice, comfortable home. Certainly has all his friends and his families with him. He was a very dejected man, though, because he was 75 years old and didn't have any progeny yet. And God said to him, go forth from your nation or your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I shall show you, and I'll make you a great nation. Oh, really? I don't even have a kid. Oh, boy, I'm going over to the promised land. God's going to give me progeny. Year went by. 2 years went by. 5 years went by. 10 years went by. 25 years went by. And still no progeny. When he was 86 years old, he had this son by Hagar. But God says, no, I'm not going to bless you through that son, Ishmael. You've got to have your own child. He's approaching 100 years of age now. He still doesn't have a progeny. I'll make of you a great nation. I'll bless you. Make your name great, so you shall be blessed. And I'll bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And finally, along comes Isaac. 100 years of age. Wife, an old woman herself. Didn't even believe it when God says, I'm going to bring you a child. She laughed about it. Not in a humorous sense, but in a disbelieving sense, really. But at the proper time the following year, she brought forth a son. What a wonderful blessing! I'm finally having a son. I'm 100 years old. 5 years went by. 10 years went by. 15 years went by. 25, approximately, if you want to guess, years went by. Maybe more or less, doesn't say. And God said, you take that young lad there, it's going to be the progeny of all the people that are going to be blessed, and sacrifice him. He waited 25 years for a son, now maybe another 25 years, and God says, sacrifice him. See, but time doesn't mean something to God like it means to us. You're all thinking about the brunch because your stomach is telling you time is going by. I hope you're not. You know what I mean? You can't go too long when your stomach says, time to eat. And they're all very physical. So in Genesis chapter 15, verse 1, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in the vision, saying, do not fear, Abram. I'm your shield. I'm a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. And Abraham said, Lord, what will thou give me since I am childless and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? That's when God promised him this child. The fact that he would have progeny all around the world staggered Abram's imagination. But that child did come, and he was told to sacrifice. Genesis chapter 21, verses 1 through 5. A lot of meaning in this chapter. You need to read this and look at the little nuances. There's a lot of them in this chapter. The Lord took note of Sarah, as he said. The Lord did to Sarah as he promised, and Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abram, Abraham at that time in his old age, at the appointed time which God had spoken to him. It says in verse 5, Abraham was 100 years old when his son was born. He waited for 25 years for a son. A little bit later on, God says, sorry, I've got to test you and try you. What are you made of? Genesis chapter 22, verse 1. Now it came about after these things. He could have been 25 years old by this time. He was now a little boy. He was not a little kid. He could have been a strapping teenager. He could have been a young adult. It doesn't say. It just says a few things that gives you an indication that he wasn't a little boy. But there's no absolute reference to time here. But God tested Abraham and said, hey, Abraham, and he said, here I am, Lord. Lesson number one, when God called, boy, you better be quick on the spot to respond. Abraham did, and he's called the father of the faithful. He said, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer for him there a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I will tell you. Waited 25 years for a son. Now maybe another 20, 25 years goes by, and God says, take him up and sacrifice him. You know, another lesson you learn from this chapter right here is God didn't argue. God didn't reason. I'm sorry, Abraham didn't reason with God. So, well, God, how you know, he did say a few things, but he knew he had some faith. Well, I know God said he's going to promise, so how's he going to work this out? Probably was a big puzzle to him for a long time. Abraham rose early in the morning, didn't waste the time, didn't kick back the little sleep in, didn't put the snooze alarm on. He got up, and he did it. He saddled his donkey and took two young men, no question about their age, they're young men, with him, and Isaac his son, and the spit wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place which God had told him. Now, I don't know how much wood it takes for burnt offering. Anybody have an idea? Well, certainly not even a quarter of a cord, but maybe a big armload. Can you see a little six-year-old boy carrying an armload of wood up a mountainside? No. The third day, that number of finality, he thought about this as he traveled for 3 days. How is God going to work this out? What is he going to do? How is he going to make it possible for all the families of the earth to be blessed when I'm about to kill my son and he doesn't have any children yet? I have no progeny. I'm maybe 125 years old at this point. Now, he obviously, if you know anything about Abraham's life, he did get remarried and have a lot more kids after that. But he would not have had Isaac. The third Abraham raised his eyes and he saw the place from the distance. Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we will return again. In his mind, he knew God was going to work it out. He knew that God was going to bring up some magical formula or something to work this whole thing out. He didn't know what it was. He was just trusting in God. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac's shoulders. So he carried the wood up there. A strapping young man? Yes. And the two of them walked on together. And Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. He said, behold, the fire rather than the wood, but there's no lamb for the burnt offering. Abraham said, God will provide it. Just have faith. Just trust me. And of course, you know the rest of the story. God stayed his hand from taking his son's life. Probably as he had his hand on the knife and was beginning to draw it right across his throat to sacrifice his son. Probably the best words Abraham ever heard. Abraham, stop! Great sigh of relief and great thanks that God had spared his son. And I could go on and tell about a lot of other people who have been given a gobs of time. You think of Moses, living in the lap of luxury for 40 long years. A general, raised in Pharaoh's house, sumptuous living at his best. Prestige, called a general, a man of importance for 40 long years. And then with another 40 years, as a sheep herder, as a goat herder. Crucible of fire and test and trial. Moses had to wander around the desert for 40 years. What's time to God? What's time to God? It took 40 years to get Abraham ready to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt. He brought them out of Egypt and they were a bunch of rebellious brats. And he said, I want you to wander around with him for another 40 years. And so Moses was 120 years old when he died. And he wasn't even able to enter the promised land. But he's a part of the group in Hebrews chapter 11 who's going to receive the promises. He's going to look back on that 120 years and think of it as just a breeze, just a little short period of time. I mean, I look back on how long my wife and I have been married and the things we have done, and it seems like yesterday. Why is it when you look back in time, everything seems so compressed, and you look forward in time, everything's so extended? 120 years. Paul! What about that fellow? We ought to look at his example because it's back down towards the New Testament in Acts chapter 8. He certainly had a life of trial, a life of problems, from the very word go. Now, he was a man who was a Hebrew of Hebrews. He was a Pharisee of Pharisees. He was an up-and-coming giant in the theological world, fought at the feet of Gamaliel. Had letters from the synagogue to take any that believed in this way of life and haul them into prison, perhaps responsible for some deaths even. Doesn't say. Chapter 8, verse 1, Saul was hearty agreement with putting him to death, thinking about Stephen. And on that day, great persecution arose against the church in Jerusalem, and they were all scattered throughout the region of Judea and Samaria except the apostles. You know the verse, Romans chapter 8, verse 28, by heart, all of you? All things work together for good for those called of God, by God. Even this great persecution of the church was used in a profitable way by God to spread that gospel out. Get it away from Jerusalem. Get it into Samaria. Get it into the most parts of the earth. It was a comfortable life. It was like living in the middle of a valley. We got a maid here, fat cows, plenty of milk, cheese, all the other good things in life. A lot of happy people, friendly people. Yanks are much appreciated, loved down in Australia. Sorry, Patty, not the British. But the Yanks are. It was the Yanks at the Coral Sea that did a lot to help Australia because the Japanese were just about ready to invade that country. Well, here's old Paul, boy. He's really threatening. Devout men buried Stephen, made loud lamentations over him. So Paul began to ravish the church, entering house after house, grinding off men and women, and he put them into prisons. And those prisons were not country club prisons. Not like some of our criminals are treated today when they're penalized in house arrest. That happened to Paul later on in life, too, but I mean, in those days, this was Paul on the giving end, not on the receiving end. I think Paul probably really appreciated the fact that he was under house arrest in Caesar's household and not in prison, as he threw so many people. Therefore, those who had been scattered went about preaching the word, doing the job of preaching the gospel to the world. All right, I've been scattered, I've been sent, I'm away from my home. Let's do something. Let's preach the gospel. How much time do I have left? God didn't tell me. Just get the job done. Let's go over to chapter 9 and verse 1. Now Paul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest, and he asked for letters from him to the synagogues at Damascus so that he might find anybody that he found belonging to that way, both men and women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. Paul was not a discriminator of sex, by the way. A male Christian or a female Christian was as good as dead in his sight. And I suppose he also treated the young and the old as miserably. He had a zeal about him, you have to admit that. Came about as he was journeying in verse 3, he was approaching to Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven flashed all around him. And he fell to the ground. Heard a voice saying to him, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? What have I ever done to you?" Well, obviously you know what happened to him. First thing you do when you have that kind of thing happen, what do? You don't say anything. You just fall down. In his case, he fell on the ground and didn't eat. Didn't do anything except pray and fast. And ask God, "What have I done wrong? And what can I do to make it right?" Maybe we ought to learn a lesson from that as well. When God deals with you, don't ask God, "What have I done?" Because you probably know what you've done. Ask Him, "What do I need to do to get right with you?" And Paul certainly did. The Lord told in verse 11, said to him, "You rise and you go to the street." This was Ananias he told, "And you go to a street called Straight, and inquire in the house of Judas for a man from Tarsus named Saul, for behold, he is praying." Smart move on his part. You know, when you're struck blind and you can't even see anything, your hand in front of your face, you know you've been dealt with in a rather severe way. And that calls for severe action, doesn't it, on your part? And prayer and fasting are always the two best. "He has seen in a vision a man named Ananias come to him, lay his hands upon him, that he might regain his sight. And Ananias said, 'Oh, Lord, I've heard of this wretched individual.'" Didn't use those words. He said, "I've heard from many about this man, how much harm he has done to the saints at Jerusalem." He has a reputation that is very bad. And wherever he goes, his reputation precedes him, and he is a danger. "You want me to heal this man?" "He has had authority from the chief priests to land, to bind all those who call upon thy name." And the Lord said to him, "You go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine. I've got a special calling for him. He's going to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the sons of Israel, and I'm going to show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake." And boy, what kind of trouble did Paul get into in his life? You want to stack up against the trials of Paul? I mean, he lived a whole life. I don't know what age he was when all this happened, but I know he died a miserable death. If all the traditions can be believed, he died in the Colosseum at the hands of wild animals. But that's after being shipwrecked numerous times, receiving 39 stripes, being thrown into prison, being stoned to death, being ostracized by many, many people. A miserable life. How would you like to be called in this calling Apostle Paul? We all have it pretty comfortably right here in Tyler. We had a wonderful feast down there. It was a wonderful feast. Wonderful time where we stayed, beautiful weather and all that. Paul says the first contact has with God is, "I'm going to show you what kind of things you're going to suffer." Paul never argued, by the way. And he did pray sometimes that God would remove certain trials and tests from him. God never did. He died a very horrible death. He was called to suffer for Christ. But 2 Timothy chapter 4 shows very plainly that Paul never gave up. He never quit. He finished the job that God gave him to do, and he's going to have a tremendous reward because he endured unto the end. He says, "God, I know, has this job for me, and I've just got to do it. I can't argue with God. I've got to do it." I don't have time to talk about the life of Christ, who lived for 33 and a half years on the edge. Have you ever tried to go 24 hours without sinning, without having a wicked thought, without making a mistake, without doing anything wrong? It's pretty tough. You have to consciously be aware. The only safe way you can do it, and then I'm not even sure, is to be praying all 24 hours. Christ lived 33 and a half years that way. Talk about a man on the edge. Because he wanted that great reward that he once had, eternal life. He didn't have time to have any bounds on him. He wanted time to disappear and live eternally again. And of course, he earned that through a tremendous trial of test, never quitting, never sinning, never married, never having children, never having any family other than a few half-brothers and half-sisters and a mother. Never enjoyed any hobbies that I'm aware of or any vacations. Just had a very tough time of it, a great sacrifice. A sacrifice far greater than any of us can ever imagine. We haven't been called martyrdom yet. You read through all these great people that died in faith, not having received the promises, and you turn to the very next chapter after that, Hebrews chapter 12, and you look at the first few verses and you're saying, what in the world was this all about? It says, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. Sin to human beings is like falling off a log sometimes. It is your way of life. I'm not talking about you folks here who are fighting against it. I'm talking about the folks in the world who don't fight against it at all. But Paul is talking to Christians here. So I can't just say he's not talking about us. He says, the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. We're in a world-class marathon. The only problem is, there's no finish line that you can see out there. Your finish line comes when you die. Or you're taken in the resurrection. Fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand, the throne of God. Was it worth it to Christ? Oh boy, was it ever. Not only what he gained from it by his great sacrifice, but the fact that he also gained all of you, if you will endure. Now, with lots of brothers in his family, which was the whole purpose of this great creation, the purpose of God from the beginning. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, that so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. Paul says, look at this chapter 11 and learn a lesson from it. Don't quit. Don't give up. Don't lose heart. The reward is too great. The sacrifice is too little. It can be your life. It is your life. What's time? What is time? I can look at my wristwatch and say, oops, time's up. And I want to read this verse in James chapter 3 and verse 13. 4, excuse me, in 13. Come now, you say, today or tomorrow we shall go to such and such a city and spend a year there, engage in business and make a profit and invest in the stock market and watch the Dow Jones, keep your eye on the Hang Seng and the Nikkei or the FTSE. No. You do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. All the crazies out there, and that certainly is true today. You're just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. If that doesn't define time, I don't know what does. We're here, we experience things, we think it's eternity, but when we look back at it, as spirit beings, we'll say, did that happen to me? Or what? Phew, I like that. And now time won't mean anything to you. You live forever. It's a great opportunity we've been given if we can qualify for God's family. We certainly should be thankful that he is interested in us. And the bottom line is, learn patience. Don't ever give up. Use your time wisely. Keep your mind on God and his reward and the hope that lies in you.